Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. American, all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the first day of June. Anno Domini 2024, and you, oh, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 8 minutes after the hour, we're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose. Take off your shoes. Don't get the blues. Have you paid your dues? Here comes the news. Although some people might worry about the National Security Agency itself spying on their phones, the NSA has some sage advice for iPhone and Android users concerned about zero-click exploits and the like. Turn it off and on again once per week. I know that sounds like a joke. Did you turn it off and on again? In a document detailing several mobile device best practices, the NSA recommends users turn off their devices and then back on again once every week to protect against zero-click exploits, which attackers often use to eavesdrop on and collect data from phones. Users can mitigate the threat of spear phishing, which can lead to the installation of yet more malware and spyware, by that same simple action. However, the NSA document does warn that turning it off and on again will only sometimes prevent these attacks from being successful. Threats to mobile devices are more prevalent and increasing in scope and complexity, the NSA said, while warning that some smartphone features provide convenience and capability, but sacrifice security. As such, doing something is always better than doing nothing when it comes to being proactive about your device and data security. The NSA also advises phone users to disable Bluetooth when not using it, update the device as soon as possible when operating system and application updates become available, and disable location services when not needed. The small matter of security over convenience comes into play for much of the advice given, as you can tell already. Throw in not using public Wi-Fi networks, these are usually perfectly safe, however, and not using public charging stations, ditto, and many users will likely roll the dice. All that said, I heartily agree with the on and off again advice, as this only takes a minute or two of your week, and it's a good habit to get into. In fact, I'd say get into the habit of doing it every day, maybe as part of your bedtime routine. Power cycling your phone once a week or even more often can certainly help you keep from being exploited. So can turning off Bluetooth when you're not active using it, installing system updates the minute they become available, disabling location services, and not using public Wi-Fi or public charging stations. Most people aren't going to do all those things, but the more paranoid among us will at least do some of them. So our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that is Bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is NSA says power cycle your phone weekly. Your choices are, I already do that. I'll start doing that now. I'll think about it. That paranoid, I'm not. So far, we've got 18 votes. And I already do that is number seven. Is seven votes. And that paranoid, I'm not, is five. So you can vote on the poll. Like I said, at soundbites.org. And, of course, you can give us a call. 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415.
One of the problems with public charging ports is the bad guys will put a fake charging port in, you know, libraries and coffee shops and whatnot, where you think it's just a charging port, but it's actually a computer. Mm-hmm. And you plug your phone in and it sucks all the data off your phone. So Apple added a feature, and I'm assuming Android has one too, that if you plug your phone into an unknown computer, it says, hey, this is a computer. Do you want to trust it? So if you, it's annoying when you plug it into your own computer and say, well, yeah, it's my computer. But that, you know, that one time
that's
out of 100. Yeah, one time out of 100, you're, you know, I just need some juice and you plug it in and there's a computer behind it. No, you don't want to plug that in there.
Right. Well, then that's the point of what I said here is there's a different, there's a dichotomy between security and convenience.
Mm-hmm.
And yes,
mm-hmm.
being secure is a little less convenient. People are complaining all the time now about two-factor authentication. Well, I have to have my phone with me. Yes, you're safer that way. I suppose if you don't care if somebody can steal your money out of your bank account.
Most people say, I don't have anything for them to steal. Well, you're wrong.
Your identity.
You've got $5. That's $5 I didn't have before.
Right.
And your identity that they can use to get some...
thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Scam other people.
I say that to my students. They say, I don't have anything you can steal. I said, you've got the single most important thing in America.
Yep.
Pristine credit.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, you at the beginning of the school year, there's always a booth somewhere on campus for giving away credit cards to kids.
Yep.
Why? Well, yeah, like because you have perfect credit.
Mm-hmm. And it's only like a $500 limit, so it's you can't get yourself into too much trouble.
Well,
but if the bad guy does that with 10 banks,
that's exactly 20
banks,
right.
There you go.
Yeah.
You can get USB cables that are charging only.
Right.
They don't have the pins for data. They just have the pins for charging. And people who travel a lot, that may be a pretty good thing to get so that you can, with a little more security in mind, use public charging ports.
Right.
Because it can only charge and it won't suck your data off.
Now, what you have to do is remember two things. One is when you buy it, look for a charging only cable.
Mm-hmm.
And mark it so that you don't start plugging it into your computer and getting angry that you can't
move sync.
Your data.
Yeah.
what I did was I bought a specifically different colored one.
Mm-hmm.
So that, if I've got it in my hand, I go, charging only.
The other thing that they're starting to happen now, especially on USB-C cables, is a wattage rating. Your phone probably charges at 5 or 10 watts. Your tablet, 20 or 30. And your computer could charge it up to 100 watts. Well, you plug a 5-watt cable into your computer because you mixed up your phone cable and your computer cable, it's going to take forever to charge.
Yeah, it's exactly going to be... Right. Well, quite often, a number...
And they're not... The cables usually aren't marked after you take them out of the packaging.
Right, yeah. Right.
Well, a number of them, though, will warn you that the system is charging slower.
Right. Yeah.
Due to the cable connected to it. And that's what it's saying, folks, is, you've got a cable that isn't going to charge it super fast like you're, hoping to, because it's not the right cable.
Right. And you can buy a lot of the little ports that you can buy, the USB or USA, USB A or C ports, will be marked.
Yeah, they have on the ring where you're putting the USB part of it into the charging unit, you'll see little numbers.
2.1, 1.5,
pay attention to it, because that makes a difference on how the unit probably can charge it faster, but you've got to plug it into the, because there's usually, there can be 2 to 4.
Right.
And the bottom one is usually, slower, and the top one is faster, but they are marked.
Right. And you have to pay attention to that. And you also want to match, by the way. So if you've got a device that came with a 1.5-watt charger, plugging into 2.5-watt connection is probably not a great idea.
Yeah, and it's not.
It's going to charge faster, but it may overstress the device.
Well, some devices will step down and not, even though it's got the supercharger coming in, it's going to sit there and say, "Yeah, no, I'm going to go at this speed and don't care."
A name brand charger with a name brand cable is safest. There have been several companies have done teardowns of knockoff cables on from Amazon, and the $10 cable versus the $1 cable,
mm-hmm.
Or the charger. People are annoyed about paying $20 for a charger. They get the $5 charger. There's no insulation between the high voltage sides and the low voltage. It takes a 120-volt connection and turns it into a 5-volt connection. And there's no insulation in there. It's just waiting to short circuit and melt.
Yep. Exactly right. Or throw 120 volts at your device.
Yeah.
Now your device is dead. Mm-hmm. Oh, you saved $9. Congratulations.
And now you got to buy a new...
a whole new phone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a... There's a lot more to it than, this one's cheaper than that one.
Yep.
Often, there's a reason it's cheaper. and that also comes with a lot of the stuff... you buy off of Temu and AliExpress and all of those places.
Yeah.
You can get some really inexpensive things, but I would never plug any of those really inexpensive things into my really expensive things.
Mm-mm.
Because it's just not worth
it. Not worth it, yeah.
If you're going to buy a little pen light or a toy of some sort, great. But if you're going to buy something you plug into your real computer, spend the extra money. Yeah.
Well, and a lot of times what we see is they're all made in the same factory.
Right.
But this batch got rejected for some reason.
Right.
Well, then it sells on Temu for half price. Well, why was it rejected? You know, is the shade of white slightly off? Because Apple would reject it for that.
Yep.
is it the wires are frayed or the connections weren't soldered properly?
Yep. I have often bought scratch and dent stuff off of Woot.
Yeah.
And they certify that the internals are okay.
Yeah.
The problem is cosmetic. I don't care.
Yeah.
So that's okay by me. If it's something else, I did get an open box item that simply could not work. I sent it back. They sent me my money back. Not a problem. They don't care. That's fine. But if you're looking for a bargain, be careful what kind
Buyer
of bargain you get.
Beware. Yeah. Yeah. Do your homework.
All right. To the phones. Our first caller is Pat from Webster, New York. What's up, Pat?
Hey, got an interesting question for you. I have a desktop computer that has a 1 terabyte hard drive and I think a 1.28 megabyte SSD. And my solid state drive is about 95% full. And I want to put a new one in. How exactly do I go about doing that? Can you give me some advice?
Now, is it your primary drive or your secondary?
Okay, so the SSD has my operating system on it and my apps. Okay. And the other drive has all my documents and photos. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that SSD must be 1.28 gig, not meg.
Probably 128 gig.
Okay. Yeah, you're probably right. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you can add a...
Maybe. What brand computer is it? Because sometimes the internal drives are now being soldered to the motherboard, and there is no slot.
But this this is a desktop unit, so 10-to-1 odds the desktop unit can handle up to 4 hard drives. You'd just have to get the power supply should have the connector as far as the power part of it. You just need the other drive cable that goes from the drive down to the motherboard.
So you'd have to look in the computer to see if the cables are already there. There's 2 cables, one for power, one for data. Likely they'd be SATA cables. If you're lucky enough to have a newer computer that has the NVMe slot or the M.2 slot, you can get a faster drive, but they're more expensive than SATA drives.
Right, so anyway, this computer is about 7 years old. It's a Dell Inspiron. And I ordered an SSD, which I thought was right. It came to the house. The SATA cable is wrong, but I thought that I could take this SSD, plug it in through my USB, and transfer or image or copy the SSD in the desktop, and then remove it.
No, it's an operating system. It's got to be formatted. If this your main one in there right now is your main boot drive,
yeah,
it's got to be reformatted, and Windows has to be reinstalled.
Or you'd have to use something like CloudZilla on a third drive to make an exact clone of from one drive to the other drive.
Right. Yep. You can do it, but it takes a special software. You can't just do a drag and drop.
And you need special hardware, too, to take the SATA drive and convert it to a USB drive.
Right.
Okay, so I thought that I could download some software and just image or copy.
No, not for free. Not for free.
CloneZilla, yes.
CloneZilla for free?
They have a commercial version of it with support and more features. But the basic CloneZilla is open source and free.
So the solid-state drive that I got, it looks like a circuit board. Is that what mine should look like?
That is probably a blade drive, and it's probably not a SATA connection then. That's probably an NVMe or M.2. So,
is it a big circuit board or a little thin one?
It's a little thin one.
Yeah,
it's an NVMe.
So you ordered the wrong drive for your unless your computer happens to have that connector on it.
Yeah, I don't think it does. I'll have to open it and find it. Now, mm-hmm. Yeah. Where about would it be? Is it going to be next to the hard drive, or
no?
Will it be obvious to me where it is?
No.
No. Yeah. It's really not going to be that obvious.
Yeah, it depends on the manufacturer of the motherboard. The best thing you can do.
Well, since you said it was a Dell brand, so you can go on Dell's. Yeah. You can go on Dell's website and download the manual for it
and see if it does. It would list whether the drive connections in it in the specs. It would tell you that you could hook up so many of this, so many of that, how many USB ports it has, and
but that there would definitely 99% there would be SATA connectors on the inside. It wouldn't have the old NVMe or IDE connectors.
I did get a build sheet when I bought the computer, but I didn't get a manual for it. So the manual might have a picture in it and show me where everything is? Or
yep. Generally speaking, you can go to Dell's support website, support.dell.com, I think, and put in the service tag number.
On the back of the computer.
Right, of your Dell product, and it will tell you everything. You can download the manual, you can download drivers, all kinds of stuff.
You could even buy drives from Dell, but they'd be probably more expensive than you get on the open market.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's why I was trying to get it on the open market, but it sounds like I'm not going to be able to replace it, though, huh? Because my operating system is on the old one?
Well, no. Well, the problem here is that you don't have the right type of motherboard that takes an NVMe drive. The drive you bought...
Yeah, I get that.
Yeah. So
Go ahead.
See,
if you were to buy the right kind of drive...
Yes.
You might have enough connectors inside to hook it up there, or you can buy a little external kind of sled thing that holds the drive and plugs into a USB, and then you download a program like CloneZilla.
And write it to a flash drive.
And write that to a flash drive and boot from that, and then say, here's my old drive, here's my new drive, clone it.
And you got to make sure you select the right ones.
Right.
Yeah. In the correct order, because if you select the new drive having the copy to the old drive, it will do it. And then when you go to boot, there's not going to be anything there because it did what you asked it to. It copied a blank drive to a full drive.
Right. You got to know the difference between
you got to take your time.
Yep.
Take your time and, read through it all.
Yeah, okay. All right.
Or like I say, the other thing you can do is just get another drive and add it as a third drive for more storage and just take what's on your current boot drive and start delegating it or install it when you're installing stuff instead of doing the default to have it install it on C, it could go to E.
Yep.
It doesn't have to go on C. As long as the registry knows where to find these programs, they do not have to be on the C drive. They can be on other other hard drives that are in that machine.
And if you're completely daunted by all of this, take it to a local shop and they can do it for you.
Yeah, it sounds like it's getting a little more complicated than I wanted.
Because you're trying to copy an operating system onto a different disk.
Yeah,
that's the tricky part.
That's the tricky part. If you were just building a new machine and just needed to add a couple of drives, easy.
Yeah.
But this is a little more.
Yeah.
And remind you, before you send any computer to any dealer in the universe, back it up.
Mm-hmm. Especially the photos and any documents. Those are the two key items that you want to make sure you have.
Back up your data.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, good point. Yep. I've got one of those little standalone 1 terabyte hard drives.
There you go. Kind of good move. Good move. Yep.
And I'll put everything on that.
Yep.
Okay. All right, gentlemen.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Now, we got so many people come into the shop and do you have your data backed up? No. Can you back it up? Computer's dead. Maybe not.
Yeah.
Well, that's the point. The point is not it's dead. Can you back it up? The point is I backed it up while it was alive. That's the point.
And because more and more computers are now coming with the storage drive soldered chips on the logic board because that makes it faster and cheaper to build. If your motherboard's dead, you cannot take the drive out and put it in another computer like you traditionally could with real drives.
And the other thing, though, is even if they're bringing you in, say, another machine and it's working, and they want you to back up the data, that's going to take time. So don't be all upset when you all of a sudden you might think your bill's going to cost this and they had to tack on some extra time because they're backing up all your data to protect you.
Well, and on top of that, let's take a look at what you're asking them to do. You're asking them to take one of their hard drives and dedicate it to you.
Yep.
You'll pay for that.
Yep.
That's not a free thing.
And if the computer is dead, it usually can't be backed up. It has to be recovered.
Yes.
Right. And
which
that's
is
much
different
more
to
that might be impossible.
Yeah.
Data saver.
$1,000 minimum.
Minimum, just to say yay or nay.
Mm-hmm.
$1,000.
Using our referral code, you get a free estimate, though.
That's nice.
And 10% off your service.
Yeah, but that doesn't even guarantee.
Yeah, they can't guarantee anything. But
right, that's just to get a year nay. It might be nay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, backing up is a whole lot cheaper than please recover my data.
And I always hated it. Well, I meant to.
Meant to, yeah.
I heard that too many times.
Yep.
It's heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking, but you know what? We can't do it for you. We cannot.
Not magicians.
I've often thought what I really need to do is start a service where I go to people's houses and back up their computers for them. The problem is nobody would pay for that service.
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, I can do that. Yeah. You can. You don't.
Yeah.
But you can.
But then when they lose those photos, that was always the tear-jerking thing.
Right. My mom.
The photos.
Yeah.
Because those you can't get back, folks. Those are gone. They're gone.
My deceased parents.
Parent.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Documents,
right.
Yes, you can rewrite those. You know, might not be word for word, but you can recreate documents.
This is
photos,
I can't tell you how many students came to me and said, my dissertation is on this thumb drive, and I can't get it back again.
Your $5 thumb drive?
Exactly. You couldn't spend $5 to get another thumb drive to back it up, but I can spend 2 weeks of my life finding it? No. Look, we're going to take... Wow. I struck a nerve in myself. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It's 29 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That's Soundbites, right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1. See you on the other side.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more Soundbites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And 35 minutes after the hour, you're listening to, and in some cases watching, Soundbites. and that's right here on Jazz 90.1. You can give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 800-790-0415. And while you do that, I'll read the news.
Oh, wait. Before I was going to say, it's so funny though that last call or first caller there was saying that he had a desktop.
Yeah,
you don't hear that too often nowadays. I mean, more folks are saying my tablet, my phone, or my laptop, is acting up. Desktops, I've said before, you go into most big stores now. You don't see the display of desktops around
anymore.
I much
prefer a desktop. I can put a lot more drives in it. I can get a much bigger screen for it. I can add all kinds of peripheral devices to it if I want
to.
More memory. I can, it's much easier to upgrade and to play around with.
But there's a chance you might want to carry it somewhere.
And I have a laptop for that. I have a Chromebook for that. I don't need... When I'm out somewhere, I don't need more than a Chromebook.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, who cares? And I do still have this laptop here, but still. You may have heard that Google's AI overviews, which are the things now that show up at the top of search, has been recommending some odd, if not stupid and dangerous things as well as outright lying to people. Some examples include using glue to get cheese to stick to pizza.
I thought that was funny.
But it would work.
It would work.
You didn't ask if it would be edible when you're done, right?
Right. Well, you can use edible glue.
Non-toxic.
Non-toxic glue.
They like the old paste we used to have in kindergarten?
Yep. Yeah. That Barack Obama is Muslim. That the best way to rid yourself of a kidney stone is to drink urine. And that adding rocks to your diet is a great source of fiber. Liz Reed, the head of Google Search, has admitted that the company's search engine has returned some, and I quote, odd, inaccurate, or unhelpful AI overviews.
Unhealthy.
End quote. After they rolled out to everyone in the U.S., she published an explanation for Google's more peculiar AI-generated responses in a blog post where it also announced that the company had implemented safeguards that will help the new feature return more accurate and less meme-worthy results. Reed defended Google and pointed out that some of the more egregious AI overview responses going around, such as claims that it's safe to leave dogs in cars, are fake. The viral screenshot showing the answer to how many rocks should I eat is real, but she said that Google came up with an answer because a website published a satirical content tackling the topic. That was The Onion. The Onion is lots of fun. Never believe a word of it.
And some animals do eat rocks to help with digestion.
Yes, just none of those animals are humans.
Yeah.
Prior to these screenshots going viral, practically no one asked Google that question, she explained. So the company's AI linked to that website. Reed said the company tested the feature extensively before launch, but there's nothing quite like having millions of people using the feature with many novel searches. Google was apparently able to determine patterns wherein its AI technology didn't get things right by looking at examples of its responses over the past couple of weeks. It has now put protections in place based on its observations, started by tweaking its AI to be able to better detect humor and satire content.
Yeah. You mean everything on the internet isn't true?
Unbelievable. It has. That's the only thing that's unbelievable.
They still in my heart.
It has also updated its systems to limit the addition of user-generated replies and overviews, such as social media and forum posts, which could give people misleading or even harmful advice. Never believe anything you read on social media or in a forum. In addition, it has also added triggering restrictions for queries where AI overviews were not proven to be as helpful and has stopped showing AI-generated replies for certain health topics. Do you blindly believe everything Google tells you? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415.
One comment here. We just had a caller. All right, folks, listen, if you're going to call the show, the one thing that I ask, well, actually two things. One, don't have your radio cranked up that I can hear me talking into because it's blaring and hearing Nick and the rest of the crew talk. And also, you know, speak up a little bit. Because we're in a studio, you don't have to talk low.
That's right. Okay.
I need to hear over these gentlemen as they're continuing on a conversation, and I'm taking the call. So
and
one,
we're not quiet.
Yeah. Pick your voice up, but please turn the radio down.
Yeah, in most radio stations that are designed for talk shows, the person that answers the phone is in another room.
Yeah.
Right.
I'd be in another, behind glass.
Right. I've done a number of experiments with Google Gemini, the chat, the AI product, and they're up on my website at asknick.com/AI tests, and some of them are okay.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are funny. I asked it about me, and it lied. It lied. Completely. I think you got one thing right somewhere in there. But in general, some of the responses are very good and very correct. It was weird. I asked it about some mythological thing. It's the first one that's on there. I think it was Thor or somebody. I asked it about mythology, and it came back with no answer. It said, I cannot answer that question. And I gave me an error code. I looked up the error code, and it said that, you know, that violates safe search. there's some something pornographic in there.
Huh?
Well, or misleading or factually incorrect.
Well,
which
no, because all the one about me is 100% factually incorrect.
But it doesn't know that.
Right. But so I had to go in and say, oh, I don't mind getting unsafe results. And it was specifically sexually related. That was the error code.
Mm.
It was sexual.
You know how randy those old myths were?
Well, now there is a lot of truth to what you just said. If you actually read any of the Norse mythology, any of the Eddas or any of that stuff, there's a lot of weird sex going on. I mean, a lot of weird sex. And there's the time that Thor married Loki. I'm not going to go in any of that. But the point is,
it's in
yes,
there.
But none of that was what I asked it about.
Yep.
And so, you know, and when I got my final answer, there was nothing in there at all about any of that stuff. So, you know, it's just weird that we're still in such early days
infancy
for that stuff. So a lot of the things are wrong. A lot of the things are odd. And you just have to be aware that you need to take it with a very, very large or possibly very, very small grain of salt.
Yep.
I don't know which way that's supposed to work. But yeah, you know, AI can do some good things when it is limited to certain things. Like they're using AI to do protein, discovering new proteins and all of that stuff. And it's limited to actual scientific facts.
Run a billion calculations.
And it works.
Yeah.
Yep.
But, you know, when you ask it to scour the internet for something, you get back what you get back.
Regular people have a hard enough time figuring out what's real or fake on the internet. How's an AI supposed to learn?
That's exactly right. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Jim from Ronacoit, New York. What's up, Jim?
Well, I'm using Thunderbird for my mailed email.
Yep.
And I'm getting probably 20 or 30 unwanted emails every day, and I just need to figure out how to stop this.
Who's your email provider? Google, Yahoo, Microsoft? What's your email address?
Not your...
The end of your address.
The end part.
Google. I mean, Gmail.
Gmail.com.
Gmail.com.
Google's
okay.
Usually good. So, yeah. Okay, yeah, Google's usually good. They've stopped millions of messages from getting to you.
Right.
So the fact that you get dozens is good.
So, yes, but here's the thing. Each of those emails, some of them you may have signed up for, not on purpose, but one of the things websites do is trick you into signing up for stuff. So if there is an unsubscribe at the bottom of the email, unsubscribe it.
But you have to be careful. If it's a legitimate email from Sears, well, if it's from Sears, it's fake. But then it's safe to unsubscribe. But there are so many fake messages that claim to be from a company that unsubscribing is bad there. So you have to be very careful about using that unsubscribe.
I get something like four or five of the same thing, like they're going to...
Your email address got put on a junk mail list, and the only thing you can do is change your email address.
Or some of those that are, if they're consistently, you know, from this company or that company, mark them as spam.
Well, and the spammers know that, and they put enough random characters or change the wording enough in the message, helped by AI now,
right?
One thing that it goes by spam filters,
right? One of the things.
Let me ask you this: How do I make one on spam? The only thing is junk, but I don't know how to do it. Spam.
What you can do
junk
is
junk and spam are synonymous. The same thing.
Yeah, they're the same thing.
Because the Hormel Meat Company hates us using the trademark of their tasty meat product.
Right.
In a bad connotation.
So one of the things that you can do is create filters from email messages. So when you get a spam message, you can go up to, I think it's tools.
I've posted a link.
Oh, okay. So Steve's put a link on how to create a filter. So one of the things that I do is I have filters for a lot of these things. Some of them are by email address. Some of them are by subject. Some of them are simply by word. So, for example, every time I get an email that has Viagra in the subject line, I immediately have the system throw it into the trash and mark it as read. I don't even see it.
Okay.
So you can do, Thunderbird is pretty good at that. So one of the things that you can do is you can set it up so that you say, when an email comes in, check it against these filters.
But you
I've probably got 50 filters, and it still takes, you know, it takes no time at all, and it happens in the background.
Okay. Well, a lot of times when I do label something junk, it comes back, and it's, I still get the email, but it's
because they're sending it from a different address.
And that new email is slightly different, so it doesn't meet the junk criteria of the previous email.
And marking something as spam is different from creating a filter.
Okay.
So, like I said, you know, there are words like Cialis and Bitcoin and all of those.
Mortgage.
Mortgage.
What if I am looking for a cheap mortgage or I have erectile dysfunction? I want those messages.
Then you take them out of your filter.
So, see, that's the problem between real junk mail and fake junk mail.
Right. So what you can do is you can take all of those words and say if it's anywhere in the title or even anywhere in the body that it just immediately gets thrown into junk. And if you look at the link that Steve sent, it'll tell you how to create filters.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Yep, good luck.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Yeah, Thunderbird is very powerful, but you have to, A, know that it can do those things, and B, know how to do those things.
And the other thing, take the time to do it.
Right.
Some mail programs call them rules rather than filters.
Right.
It's the same kind of thing.
It's the same thing. And just like junk and spam are the same thing, rules and filters are the same thing. So, yeah, I use Thunderbird consistently. It's excellent. It's excellent. But you do have to tweak it. And we've said this before. Gmail is the best of all of the main email providers.
Probably Gmail followed by Apple.
Followed by Apple.
And Yahoo and Microsoft are the worst.
Are the worst.
Because especially Yahoo, because the whole point of Yahoo is to sell ads.
Right.
So they don't want to stop ads coming through Yahoo.
Right. And so you can pretty easily create very powerful filters in Thunderbird. So if you've got a Yahoo address or, you know, whatever, you can essentially create your own filter system.
And that's the other thing that's nice about a mail reader like Thunderbird. Apple has their own mail reader, but Thunderbird also runs on a Mac, is you can check your email from multiple sources in one place. So if I have two Google addresses, an Apple address, and a Microsoft address, I don't have to go to four separate websites to look at it.
Right.
I can look at it in one program.
Right. I have, I think, eight now email addresses.
Although, every now and then, I had one yesterday, a customer will come in, so my email's gone.
Six.
In the Apple Mail Reader and in Thunderbird 2, you can collapse the list of mailboxes.
Right.
So if you want to focus on like one mailbox, you can collapse the other ones out of the way. If you accidentally collapse the mailbox, you can't see your inbox anymore.
Right.
Because you clicked on that little tiny icon.
Arrow.
So then you have to click that, find that little arrow to click it again to expand it back again.
Right.
The other thing, though, I like about Google, you know, having six email addresses, I also have six storage areas which hold 15 gig of stuff.
Each.
Yeah.
Yep.
That I can put stuff and I, you know, back it up to here or there, the other stuff that I'm trying to do. And it's great because it's free. Yep. It doesn't cost me a penny. Yep. And they're just open up the email account and away
and
you
doing
go.
Doing it that way also lets you separate things. So I'm putting all the home finance stuff here and all my, you know, motorcycle stuff here. And
well, the other thing, too, is you can create one if, you know, some of these sites want an email address. All right, I just put this one in because I know if I see that pop up, I know where, you know, it came from, you know, that they're selling it to other people. And I don't care because I don't look at those.
I have a separate email address in Thunderbird that I never look at. And same I have a filter that says every time something comes in, just mark it as read.
Yep.
And so it never gets in my way. It never bothers me. Everything that comes there is marked as read. and I have it set to delete in a day. So, you know, whenever I've got a new thing I've got to do, I give it that email address, and I can go in and look at it and say, okay, they sent me a code or whatever, yeah. or whatever yeah. they sent. And but now I'm on some list of theirs. I don't care. I'm never going to see those emails. Yeah, one ever
the,
in my life.
One of the reasons we're seeing kind of an upturn in that kind of spam is Google's threat to block, to stop accepting cookies.
Right.
So in a future version of Chrome, they're going to stop accepting cookies because the bad guys use cookies for tracking.
Right.
Of
course, so does Google.
So does Google, right. So they figured out a new way.
Right.
But currently the EU is suing them because a spammer, a direct marketer, complained that the EU, that this change in Chrome is going to destroy their business. Well, yeah, because you're a junk mailer. We don't want your junk.
Right.
But more and more companies now, instead of relying on cookies, because most people have a cookie blocker anyway, they require you to make an email account to sign in. It's free. Just give us your email address.
Right.
So now you get a bunch of junk mail from them, and they mm-hmm. sell your address to other people. You get even more junk
yep,
mail.
More.
So
yep.
now, crud. So blocking third-party cookies almost doesn't matter anymore because companies are making you create a first-party relationship by giving them your direct email address.
And it used to be that you can, in Gmail, create plus or dot addresses.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say my address was a wonderfulguy at gmail.com. So I go to Sears to buy something, and they want my email address. I could say wonderfulguy plus Sears at gmail.com. It would still come to me. But now if they sell my address, I know it came from Sears.
Yep.
Or wonderfulguy.sears at gmail.com.
Yeah.
So, but now a lot of companies are blocking plus and dot. Well, not so much dot emails because a lot of companies use a dot. But they're blocking plus emails. So you can't sign up for something if you got a plus in the name.
So then you got to make an alias.
Then you make an alias. Mm-hmm. Or, like I said in my case, I have a Gmail address that's nothing but a series of random yep. numbers, and I give it that one.
Yeah, Gmail addresses are free. Make as many as you want.
You make mm-hmm. as many as you want. And,
for now.
For now.
Yeah.
Just like, well, and well, as long as they are, that's right. how I'm going to do it.
How many free products has Google either killed or made pay?
Right, right, right. Do you know the guy who created Gmail from Rochester? He did. It was.
Really?
Yeah. At any rate, the point here is if you need those to sign up for something that you never intend to use ever again, ever, create yeah. a Gmail account.
And like I say, the free storage is well worth it. The other benefit.
That's exactly right. That
if you want to back up, say, any documents or anything else that you need to put there, you know, it's a cloud-based service, 15 free gig, you know, by just opening up a simple Gmail account.
Yep. And so, you know, there are things that I put in that space that I, you know, I want to have them, but I don't care if somebody gets at them.
Yeah.
Because I've now made that address extremely public. So, mm-hmm. you know, I don't care.
Yeah. No, like one of them I just use for downloads that I'm downloading mm-hmm. programs.
Right.
Off the internet. And it sits there and I want to keep them just yep. to kind of double check. And I can just go to that drive letter and, oh, yeah. But again, it's free storage.
Right.
I don't have to keep it on my computer and worry about, you know. Right.
I back up all my programming files, the programs I write.
Mm-hmm.
It's one place to back them up. And
perfect.
If I'm on a different machine and I want that program,
up you go. It's cloud-based. You've got it no matter whether you're on your laptop or you can do it with your cell phone. You know, that's the beauty of the cloud, and that's what we've been saying for a couple decades now, that, you know, the cloud-based stuff is so great, makes people's lives a lot easier, that, you know, if you're out somewhere, say, in the West Coast, and you live here in the East, and you want to show the family, say, some photos, no problem. You can just, on your phone, hook up to the cloud and show them all the photos that you want.
I just did that for our rocket launch last weekend. Everyone there wants to see pictures of their own rocket.
Of course.
That it's hard to take pictures of your own rocket because
you're kind of busy.
You're busy, yeah. So, yeah, I sent off three or four links to, here's a bunch of pictures I took.
Well, one of the things I do is I have an album in Google Photos for family.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Every time I take a picture about the family, I send it there. And everybody who's in that group gets a notice that says new pictures in family. So they can go and look and comment. And
yeah, I get them weekly from my stepson on my grandson.
Yep.
All the different ones, you know, and the little news clips and everything else. And it's always great.
He's the first grandson, isn't he?
Yep.
Yeah.
No.
For them.
Well, on that
for
side.
Them. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. For them. Yeah. Yes, first
it's
child for them.
One and only. Yeah.
Well, because we all know first one gets a million pictures.
Yeah.
Yeah, by the time it's the third one, it's like, get out of my way.
Yeah. But yeah, right now, yeah, it's great. Ever so the phone goes off, and there's current pictures of Hunter, whether he's at daycare or whatever.
Right,
he is.
Right.
So, yeah,
and,
I love it.
And that's a beautiful way to share that stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, it used to be, I'm old, and I admit this. You have to print multiple copies of things and all of that.
Remember
nonsense.
When double prints became automatic?
Remember when double prints were half price?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and now it's just, I've got it up. And people, you know, who makes photo albums anymore? Some people do, but most people, I've got it on my phone, you know, and I can share the original.
Big thing, the big thing now are smart picture frames that you can give to your parents or grandparents, and you can add photos to it over the internet. Right. I fear the security of some of those and what photos might
no
show
security,
up.
But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, matter of fact, I was just at a dinner with my siblings. And my one sister, because she's moving down to Florida, all of a sudden presented us with this one picture that she had for decades of my parents being married.
Oh, nice.
Old black and white. And it was like, holy macaroni. I didn't know if that still existed.
Right.
But, yeah.
Even an old, I'm looking at picture frames, an old tablet. You've got an old 9-inch, 10-inch tablet you don't use anymore. Make that a picture frame for your parents.
Yeah, exactly right. All right. Well, that music tells us that the first hour of this show is done. But do not despair. There's a whole nother hour of the longest running computer show in the known universe coming your way. It's a whole nother hour of Dave Van Wright, a whole nother hour of Steve Ray, a whole nother hour of Nick Francesco, and a whole nother hour of you if you give us a call. 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299, toll-free 800-790-0415. This is a slightly longer break, so you've got time for a bio break. Grab yourself a sandwich and an adult beverage, but come on back, because there's a whole lot more sound bites coming your way on the truly great and truly grateful to you, because we are solely member-supported Jazz 90.1. See you on the other side.
Computer talk you can understand. More sound bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
This is WGMC Greece Rochester, a public service of the Greece Central School District and official media partner of this year's CGI Rochester International Jazz Festival. Jazz 90.1.
On Facebook at Jazz 901 FM.
Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And in 5 minutes after the hour, you are hurtling headlong into the second hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites, right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415. The U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which is the CISA,
CISA,
has added a critical security bug in Linux to its list of vulnerabilities known to be actively exploited in the wild. The vulnerability carries a severity rating of 7.8 out of a possible 10. It allows people who have already gained a foothold inside an affected system to escalate their system privileges. It's a result of a use-after-free error, which is a class of vulnerability that occurs all the time in software written in C and C++, where a process continues to access a memory location after it's been freed or deallocated. Use-after-free vulnerabilities can result in remote code or privilege execution. The vulnerability, which affects Linux kernel versions 5.14 through 6.6, resides in the NF underscore tables, a kernel component enabling the net filter, which in turn facilitates a variety of network operations, including packet filtering, network address and port translation, packet logging, user space packet queuing, and other packet mangling. It was patched in January, but as the CISA advisory indicates, some production systems have yet to install it. A deep dive write-up of the vulnerability reveals that these exploits provide a very powerful double-free primitive when the correct code paths are hit. Double-free vulnerabilities are a subclass of use-after-free errors that occur when the free function for freeing memory is called more than once for the same location. The write-up lists multiple ways to exploit the vulnerability, along with code for doing so. The double-free error is the result of a failure to achieve input sanitation in NetFil. People don't sanitize their inputs. Ever. Little Bobby tables.
Mm-hmm.
When NF underscore tables and unprivileged user namespaces are enabled. Some of the most effective exploit techniques allow for arbitrary code execution in the kernel and can be fashioned to drop a universal root shell. CISA has given federal agencies under its authority until June 20th to issue a patch. The agency is urging all organizations that have yet to apply an update to do so as soon as possible. And that includes you. Do you keep your Linux up to date? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415. There's, you know, we're seeing in the Linux community the same kind of boneheaded nonsense that the Apple community was
too
guilty of for too long. The complacency of saying nothing, my system is secure. No. It's not. There is no secure operating system. Get over yourself. That includes iPhones and Android phones and tablets and your desktop and your laptop and your watch and everything else. These things are not secured properly all the time. So you need to update now.
Because it's faster not to.
Right.
And companies want their jobs done fast, get the code done, get it out. We'll worry about bugs later.
But I think the hackers see it more as a challenge now because we've been saying too long, you know, back in the day it was apples are the most safe things. You know, don't worry about it being they took that on as a challenge.
Yep.
And now to sit there and say any system is, you know, totally hack-free, not anymore.
Well, so the question is, who do you want to find your bugs?
Right.
Your programmers or the bad guys? Someone's going to find the bugs.
Right. And you know, you're right. We used to be complacent. We used to say, well, you know what? There aren't enough Macs out there for anybody to care about. There aren't enough Linux systems out there for anybody to care about. Well, it's never been true of Linux systems since they've run the internet. But even so, computers don't care.
Yeah.
They will take a look at your system and say, oh, you're a Windows machine? Great. Here's the bug for you.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the exploit for you.
What's that?
Oh, you're a Mac? Here's the exploit for you.
What's that prepackaged exploit kit?
There's several of them.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of them out there where you can buy exploits. You can go on the dark web, as they call it, and buy a script to run. And it comes...
Metasploit.
Metasploit.
That's probably
which
one of the big ones,
you can use with everything. So, again, it goes and finds your machine and says, oh, you're running Linux. Here's the exploit for Linux. You know, you're running a Mac. Here's the exploit for Mac. So, yeah, they may look for Windows first because that's the most common desktop operating system, but they look for all of them.
That's just lazy programming to stop at Windows.
Well, exactly. There's
no
problem.
Fortunately, most bad guys are kind of lazy.
There's only
two or three people that actually can write this stuff. The bad code.
Right.
And then they write the metasploits or they write the scripts, and then someone else picks it up, and generally they're called script kiddies. kids that just look at scripts. And
it's a very derogatory term, by the way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And but what we've seen, even in real world examples, is what was the big one? Intel published a framework of code to use for some chip thingy. And companies used the framework example in live published code. And it didn't work right because it was just supposed to – here's the idea of how you write this code. And it was showing up in live code, causing bugs in programs, you know, years later.
Yep. And look, programs are written by humans. They are going to make mistakes. They are going to get lazy. They're going to take shortcuts. And all of those things are exploitable by the bad guys. So keep your systems up to date. I just got a huge update to LibreOffice. Now, on Linux, it's real easy. I just say, go ahead and do the update.
Yeah.
And then I just go back to whatever I'm doing. It happens in the background. I never have to reboot. I never have to do anything. But every operating system, anybody using LibreOffice, when it comes up and says, you should update this, you should update this.
Yep.
Because
for
there's
your own
exploits
good.
Out there. Right. It's only for your own good. And everybody's like, look, and I particularly get it when it comes to Windows. Because in the past, every time you updated anything, you had to reboot. Oh, I got a new driver for the mouse, better reboot. And I get that. I absolutely get that.
At least now you can schedule a reboot at night.
You can schedule reboot at night, assuming you remember to leave your computer on. And it used to be that, you know, back when I was at RIT, I would tell my faculty, I would remind them every time we had a faculty meeting, turn your computers on before you go into class. You know, you're doing office hours before class anyway. Turn your computer on there and let it update before you get into class. Constantly. I just started class and now my computer's updating. What do I do? Now you wait. That's what you do now.
Yep.
There's nothing I can do for you. I'm not Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
The other day I had hit start update when I left the office.
Yeah.
And I come in the morning and there's a program saying, are you sure you want to quit?
Oh, I hate that. Oh. What a pain in the butt.
All right, we'll
hold
that off again. And I don't think I have got that installed yet.
Yeah, right. Yes, and I've seen that happen. Well, I bought a computer which ended up not working correctly, so I sent it back. I couldn't get into the BIOS, but it was locked. It was a refurb.
An issue.
The thing was locked. But the first thing I did, it came with Windows, so I did an update.
Fresh out of the box, it almost always needs an update.
It mm-hmm. not only needed an update, but it took hours.
Yep.
And my favorite part of the update was it said, you know, it's going to reboot a few times.
Yeah.
I said, mm-hmm. okay. I was watching it, you know, sitting on the desk next to me while I was working.
You look over and the screen is black. Oh, what happened?
All right. Well, I looked over and it said 58% completed. Then it rebooted and said 24% completed. Okay, that checks. That's Microsoft for you. That checks.
Well, that was 58 of the last update.
Yeah,
now it's 24.
Yeah, depends on what phase of it.
That's why Apple has released a tool into their own stores. We don't have it yet. That they can update iPhones in a sealed box.
Right.
So that it always has the latest OS. Because it's such a pain when a customer buys a new phone. It takes an hour to load the new OS so you can copy their data over. Because their phone probably has a newer OS on it, and it won't let you. So that's the first problem. It won't let you copy a device that has a newer OS. I can understand that. But it's really nice that it's able to, it uses the near-field communication system to wake the phone up. So the phone isn't completely off during shipment. It wakes it up enough.
Phones are never completely off.
Yeah.
We need to understand that.
We're hoping they're going to add that to tablets and computers eventually.
That's one thing that they got lazy on. Is when they were doing updates, what they used to do, folks, if you remember, they used to have a little window and you'd see this bar going across mm-hmm. and it'd say the percentage. So then when you reboot and all of a sudden you see, now it's 20%? Yeah, it's 20% of this new task that it's doing.
Right.
And they used to have a little bar. They just blank it out right now and just shoot the number up there because of lazy programming.
Well, and I read an interesting essay on one of the programming forums where they were calling basically to eliminate progress bars because they always lie.
They always lie.
So, and because the programmer has no idea how long it's going to take.
Right.
I have to install 20 things. If it takes a minute to do one, okay, it's going to take 20 minutes to do them all. But no, then it took 10 minutes to do number two. Oh, okay, now it's going to make 2 hours to do them all.
Right.
So it never knows, so just don't bother putting a progress bar up.
Well,
but then people, right, when you're installing the thing, if
but
there's no...
see that progress, yeah, if, is being made.
So how many times have you stared at a progress bar that looks stuck?
Yeah.
Is it just busy, or did it stop? How long am I going to wait before I restart the computer?
Well, the easiest thing to do is just
never
move your mouse over to that bar.
And see if it moves a pixel forward.
Yeah. Just see if it goes past it.
Never try to restart your computer in the middle of a system update.
It can mess things up so bad.
Yeah.
Just wait. If you have to wait 3 days, just wait. One of the nice things about Linux, when you do it on the command line, it does have a bar, and it puts a little bunch of octothorpes across to 100%, but it's not timed.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I've got 20 things to do. I did one, so, you know, it's done 5%.
Yeah, it shows the items as they count down.
Right.
And they'll give a time limit.
Yep.
Right. Yeah, I've got 20 tasks to do. I'm done with the first one. Now I'm going to the second one. You're seeing the progress that way, and the bar moving along as it's doing a task.
Right.
In the olden days of dial-up modems, if someone emailed you a picture, you're downloading your email. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Yeah.
7, 8, 9, 10.
Yep.
Yep. Yeah. And it's look, there's no easy fix for that. The problem is that, as Steve said, programmers can't tell how long something is going to take. And it's different on different machines as well.
Yeah, if you've got a fast processor with lots of RAM, it's probably going to be
faster. Well, that's
faster.
The thing. We've gotten so complacent that we've forgotten, you know, this might take a little time. We want instant gratification no matter what.
Yeah, instant gratification isn't fast enough anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's slower than beans. No, you want slow. Let me take you back to the old dial-up days, folks.
That's exactly right.
After 17 hours of downloading this song from Napster, your mom picks up the phone. Ah!
Yeah.
And yep.
You
been
get
there.
To start all over again.
What's Napster? Why would you pick up a phone, and why would that just mess up the download?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, they forget too easily way things used to be.
Yeah.
And, oh, they're complaining because it might take, an extra 15 seconds.
Yeah.
Where before it could take 15 minutes.
Well, I told you, my a couple weeks ago we had a power problem in the house, and it killed my Greenlight modem.
Oh, yeah.
And, yes, I know it's an ONT, not a modem. Shut up. And so, you know, that was a Thursday night. And so I had to go Friday morning and pick up they were very good about it. And they had it waiting right for me. It was great. But, Thursday night was late. There's, you know,
yeah,
it's fair that they couldn't. So I was using my phone. It wasn't as bad as dial up, but it wasn't good.
Yeah.
I had a hot spot
on
still,
my phone. But it's still an avenue that you could pursue.
Right.
Than being dead in the water.
Right. But, my first modem was 150 baud. That's 150 mm-hmm. characters per second.
And you downloaded a 10K file, and it took an hour.
And it took an hour.
Yeah.
And then I got a 300 baud modem and a 12 and a 24.
And you downloaded a 10 meg file. It took an hour.
It took an hour. 56.6K modem, I remember.
I remember.
Now we're downloading 10 gig files and 100 gig files, and it takes an hour.
Right.
I can remember, though, when first got into it, and my late wife came into the den, and that's back when I had the 300 baud modem, and she just looks at me and she goes, David? Then I knew I was in trouble, because no one calls me David unless my mother called me that, and I was in a deep doo-doo.
Yep.
So, she's standing there in the doorway with this piece of paper in her hand. And said, David, we got to talk. Well, okay, what? She goes, I don't mind you being on the computer. I know you enjoy it, and you're doing it for school. But when the phone bill is more than the mortgage payment, we got an issue.
Yep.
I guess I got to get a faster modem.
Yep.
Yep.
So I was able to justify going up to a 4,800 baud modem.
And then we joined FidoNet and let Phil pay for all the long-distance calls.
That's exactly right. And then you came to me and said, what's this Roadrunner thing? Yep. Can I get on that? So I helped him get set up with Roadrunner. And the instant I set it up, it was like I had disappeared.
Yeah.
That was down
at my shop.
And that was only hunched over.
It was only 10 megs in the beginning.
Yeah.
We went from 57K to 10 megs.
Yep. It was hunched over and playing and playing. I said, do you need anything? Nope. Can I help you? Nope.
Well.
And then I said, you're going to go to bed tonight, right? And he went, oh, yeah. He said, should I call you in the morning? He said, no, I can do this. And then at 6 a.m., my phone rang, and he violated the FCC regulation about what you can say over the phone lines.
Well, the thing of
like
it was...
Like, it was my fault. Yeah.
When you set it up for me, it was down at my shop.
Yep.
And you got to understand, folks, it was... the old DSL was, a D-SLAM, so it was how far you were from the D-SLAM.
Right.
For me and my shop, all I had to do was pound on the wall, because the switching station for DSL was on the other side of the wall where my shop was.
In the complex.
So, yeah. So there. So, of course, Nick gave me all the tools to do this that I hurried home. I got so entrenched in setting it up that I missed two wake-up calls.
Yes.
Used to be there was a 20,000-foot limit on your DSL. And, Dave, how far away are you? 2 feet.
2 feet.
Yeah. Literally.
Yeah. See that wall you can touch?
Yeah. That was great.
But he called me. So he didn't even say who he was. This is in the days when we had phones. You don't remember phones, people. But we had phones where you didn't know who was on the other end when you picked it up.
And that was after my second wake-up call.
That's right. And he calls me and he swears at me. He didn't say who he was, but I knew immediately who it was and what it was about. I laughed all day long. All day long, because I had told him, I know you, you're going to go down the rabbit hole, and you're never coming back. Oh, no, I'll go to bed. It's not a problem.
There was a Doonesbury cartoon like that once where, I forget which character was the writer, Doonesbury, and he was writing in two or three frames, and he's typing away on his typewriter, and then the sun comes up outside the window, and then his daughter comes in, Mom, Dad forgot to go to bed again.
Yep.
Sometimes you get that flow going, you can't stop.
And I told you on the phone, I said, don't have Lori call me, it's not my fault.
that evening, my butt was dragging.
Yeah, really?
I mean, I almost did a nosedive into the old mashed potatoes in that. Because I was having trouble, and she goes, well, I guess we're not going to have trouble sleeping tonight, are we?
Good thing you owned your own business and could set your own hours.
Exactly.
And had a partner that could handle the call.
Yeah. I mean, oh, God love my old staff. I mean, I had a great group of folks that were working for me. And, yeah, I could afford to do things like that once in a blue moon. But as folks know, when you're in business for yourself, you can't take too many days off.
That's right.
And I always hated that one. Oh, you're in business for yourself. You got it made. You can take off whenever you want. True. That's totally true.
Absolutely.
But then
true.
You got to realize one other thing, folks. If I take off, I'm not earning money, so I don't get paid.
Yep. Right. That's exactly right.
Yeah, that's the problem with owning your own business is you can never go on vacation.
Right.
Because then you don't get paid.
Right.
Good.
And you're not doing any work.
And yes, you can hire excellent people, but you don't always have excellent people. Mm-hmm. And you have to manage their time as well. And sometimes your best people are not available either.
Yeah. We often say at our office that we should be open more on the weekends. You know, retail store open on the weekends, when people can't come after work during the week sometimes. But then, well, who wants to work all weekend? Nope.
Right.
None of us want to work 7 days a week. We're already doing 6 days a week.
Yep.
And every time we try to hire someone to extend those hours, it never works out.
Mm-mm.
Yep.
Especially with something as technical as computer sales.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot easier at you know,
retail,
a lot of retail stores where, yeah, you know, you just scan the barcode on the device.
Right. Here's the shirt. Shut up.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Okay, now we're going to get calls.
Does this shirt look good on me?
I understand. I understand. Back to the phones, our next caller is Larry from Rochester, New York. Hi, Larry. What's up?
Good afternoon, guys. I have problems. we all have problems, but my mail app on my Mac is now getting to the place when I open it up, I have sometimes 35 of these no sender, whatever they are, things. I've tried to set some kind of filter or whatever it is, and I'm just having I'm not being successful with it. And so I'm thinking about just taking the mail app off my desktop and just staying with Gmail or something else. I think I've transferred everything over to Gmail. Don't get anything there showing up strange, but is there any way to stop this stuff? It's getting worse and worse.
And the program you use to read your mail has nothing to do with it because the mail's going to come in. You can, in the Apple Mail, under preferences, it's called rules, where you can make a rule on a message. The problem is the bad guys know how to make rules too.
It's that same game of leapfrog.
Yeah, and so they will change enough about the message so that it doesn't get caught by that rule next time.
And I've tried that, and it just doesn't work. I mean, I look up and the same thing is there, and it's...
But it's not the same thing. So, it's different enough that it bypassed your rule.
So let's say you make a rule that says you don't want to get mail from Joe 123. Well, the next one comes in from Joe 124. Bypasses your rule.
Yeah. So if the one of the common ways is subject. So if the subject is get cheap drugs, and that's your rule, and the next message comes in, drugs are cheap, the rule misses it.
Right.
So, you know, like Nick said earlier, you know, use one or two words. So if it says drugs, delete it. If it says Viagra, delete it. You know, mortgage, delete it. Use as few words as possible in your rule, because the odds of that exact same message coming through again are almost zero.
Right. And you can, you know, one of my rules is anything that comes from .ru.
Yeah.
Or .ch.
Okay. So yeah, if you don't routinely exchange mail with someone in Russia or China, right, then you can block a lot of those domains. I wish there was an automatic way to block non.com domains. But most of the junk mail comes from .com anyway.
Right. So it's a never-ending thing, Larry, and I get it. It's annoying and it's frustrating.
Yeah, using Google as your email provider
helps
because they do block a lot of spam before it gets to you. But yeah, you can use the Apple Mail program to read your Google email, no problem.
Right.
What about iCloud? Suppose I use iCloud Mail. I haven't done it yet, but if I set it up in for iCloud, would that help?
Google and Apple, well, I'd probably give the nod to Google, but Apple is also very good at blocking spam before it gets to you. But the big problem is now you got to tell everyone your new email address if you change your email address, which is sort of the only way to stop spam until your new email address gets put on spam lists.
Right.
Great.
All right, listen.
Okay.
Larry, we got to go. Thanks.
I appreciate it. I'm going to go try some of that right now.
Okay, good luck.
Yep.
We're going to take a quick break, back in just a couple of minutes with Sound Bites right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1. It's 29 minutes after the hour. We'll be right back.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And in 34 minutes after the hour, we are Sound Bites. And you can give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 800-790-0415. The U.S. Treasury Department has sanctioned three Chinese nationals for their involvement in a VPN-powered botnet with more than 19 million residential IP addresses they rented out to cyber criminals
to obfuscate their illegal activities, including COVID-19 AIDS scams and bomb threats. The criminal enterprise, the Treasury Department said on Tuesday, was a residential proxy service known as 911S5. Such services provide a bank of IP addresses belonging to everyday home users for customers to route internet connections through. When accessing a website or other internet service, the connection appears to originate with the home user, not with the bad guys. The Treasury officials also sanctioned three Thailand-based businesses: Spicy Code Company Limited, my favorite name, Tulip Biz Pattaya Group Company Limited, and Lily Sweets Company Limited.
Do you think they're related?
You think? I don't know. I like Spicy Code Company Limited.
Yeah. The official, that's some spicy code.
Right. The official said the 911S5 botnet comprised roughly 19 million IP addresses in the U.S. Criminals used it in tens of thousands of fraudulent applications related to coronavirus relief scams that resulted in the loss of billions of dollars to the U.S. government. The IP addresses compromised by the service were also linked to a series of bomb threats made throughout the United States in July of 2022. Tuesday's action comes 6 days after researchers from Google-owned security firm Mandiant said that the use by Chinese Nexus threat actors of residential proxy networks known as operational relay bot networks was hindering traditional means of tracking and defending against cyber attacks. Mandiant researchers urged defenders to adopt new approaches. So do you still trust your VPN? Why? And why do you think it makes you anonymous? Give us a call, but use your real name, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free 800-790-0415.
We've said for years, if you're using a free VPN service, they're getting their money from somewhere.
Yeah,
that's right. Even if you're paying for the VPN service, you are not anonymous on the internet. The entire idea of a VPN is to encrypt traffic from you to the VPN. That's it.
Game over.
Once it gets to the VPN, it is decrypted. So the question is, do you trust the VPN? Because they will be able to read everything you do.
As it is now, your internet service provider can read almost everything you do.
Right.
So you're switching it from there. So one of the side effects of the Snowden leaks that said the NSA is spying on us all is that most web traffic is now encrypted.
Right.
So it's encrypted on your computer and decrypted at the other end. So right. You don't need a VPN for that anymore anyway.
Right.
But the endpoints are not encrypted. So your ISP knows what websites you're going to because it's taking you there.
Right.
And so now that's becoming the information they sell about you. So a VPN does hide that from your ISP, but now the VPN knows it, and they could sell that.
And they probably are.
Yeah.
So there's no, you know, look, if you're going to do stuff that you don't want people to know about, the best way to do it is in a small submarine at the bottom of the ocean where no one can see you. And you're not connected to the internet in any way, shape, or form. But the simple reality is that if you are connected to the internet, somebody knows who you are and what you're doing. I've said this before. I got a letter from Universal Pictures that said, "Oh, you downloaded this movie from a dark website." Oh, the dark web, that's supposed to be secure. No, it's not. Of course, again, it wasn't me who did it. I was the owner of record for all the computers in the College of Business, and somebody else had done it, and we dealt with that. But the point is, this kid thought he was completely
anonymous.
Obscured, completely anonymous on the internet because he was using somebody else's computer to go to a dark website, and they knew what computer it came from. The Universal, the movie downloaded was The Waterboy. I'm going to steal a movie. It's not going to be The Waterboy. So Universal, I think that was Universal. I think it was Universal. Anyway, the point is they knew what machine it had gone to. I have records as who used that machine at that time.
And game over.
Even if you go to a public coffee shop or like a public library to use their computer, the other end knows what computer they sent it to.
That's exactly right.
And then the police show up to that building and say, "Give us your security cameras." You see this on cop shows all the time.
All the time.
Mm-hmm.
all the time. And the reality is that you are not anonymous on the internet. I don't care who you think you are or how you think you're going or what you think you're doing. You are not, in fact, anonymous on the internet. You can be found.
Right. They may not know it's you by name, although they probably do.
No, they probably
do. And that goes back to the earlier thing. Turn off your Bluetooth when you're not using it.
Right.
So many apps use Bluetooth for tracking. When Apple added the warning that your Bluetooth is being used to the iPhone, Facebook popped up and said, you're using Bluetooth. What does Facebook need Bluetooth for? I'm not using a headset. So Bluetooth is primarily used to listen to music with your headset.
Right.
Why does Facebook want Bluetooth? So it can track you.
So it can track you. People just turn it on all the time. And this is my favorite thing. Oh, I use a VPN at home, so I can't be tracked. But you carry a phone that has Bluetooth turned on, that has locations turned on, that's on all the time. They know who you are, they know where you are, and they know what you're doing. Also, every computer has a signature. And it's not something embedded in the chip, although there are those as well. But it's also your exact, nobody else on earth has your exact configuration of computer.
That was the
panopticlet. And so that's a fingerprint.
Like your unique address where you live.
Right.
Granted, there might be different main streets, but it goes down right to the city, the zone.
And the important thing here is that they know, look, I go to a secure website on the dark web and it gets that signature. Okay, maybe you think it doesn't know who I am. And let's say it doesn't. But then you go to some regular website with the same exact machine. It's got the same exact signature. They're all trading signatures back and forth. They now know who you were on the dark web.
And there are so many things in the HTML specification that you can use for signatures. How many fonts do you have installed? Which fonts do you have installed? What's the size of your window? So there was one the other day about clocks. So it knows exactly what time down to the nanosecond your computer clock is at, because everyone's is slightly different.
Yep.
So there's a website it's the Panopticlick service, but now they call it Privacy Badger, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I don't know about Privacy Badger, but it will look at your website and see how non-anonymous you act, not your website, your web browser, and see how not really anonymous you are.
Right. And you're not.
No.
So you really need to be aware that...
Well, that's why some of these ads that you're seeing on TV right now, the dark web, and
they want to sell you a product. So they're going to say it's the best thing since sliced bread.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's not, folks. Don't get complacent on that.
I used to have a page that told you what I knew about you when you went to my website. I took it down because people were scared. How did you get that information?
Well,
you're sending it to me. That's how I got it.
And hello, it's out there, folks. You just don't take the time to learn that it's getting out there or read up on it.
Yep. One of the things that we've talked about for years, Facebook puts a universal cookie on your computer. That means that it can talk to every website you go to, every single one. That's why I do Facebook with a browser that I don't use for anything else. That universal cookies, at least so far, can't jump from browser to browser.
And we've talked about how insidious smart home appliances seem. Yeah. That you're talking with a friend about buying a new car, and your Alexa device hears that, and you start seeing ads for new cars. It must be listening to me. No, it's more insidious than that. The friend you're talking to probably searched for new cars on his phone.
Right.
Your phone knew it was near his phone.
Or if you accidentally type in that you're looking for a refrigerator or something like that, bam, you're going to get...
I do web searches for my wife all the time. Back when she was working, she, in her job, she couldn't spend time farting around on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So she would call me and say, can you look this up? Can you look I get ads for things you would...
Yep.
Not believe.
She's joking. Around Christmas time, I used to buy romance novels for my wife for Christmas presents.
Sure.
So for the next 6 months, I get ads for romance novels.
Yep.
Fortunately, she's out of that phase.
Good.
Yeah, but no, if you look up insurance, I guarantee you that afternoon you're going to be bombarded with ads and everything else, or advertisements about car insurance. Yeah.
And even if you use a different browser, it's still coming from your address,
right?
Your IP address.
So the Facebook app on your phone knows it's near the Facebook app on this other phone.
Right.
It knows how close you are because of Bluetooth. Right. It knows how long you were there. You probably know each other. So I'm going to give you similar ads to what he's been searching on his phone.
Right.
Because, you know, you were together for 25 minutes. You probably have similar interests.
Yep.
And even if you don't, I'm going to send you ads.
Right. Yeah.
Down here's another one for you. I was, because it doesn't have to even be on my computer. I want to have my deed changed.
Yeah.
Okay. Because it was, you know, public record, and they're filing it, just doing some updates in that. All of a sudden, you start getting all these ads that, well, you know, you should have this, and you should have this, and it's like, yeah, no, I don't need that stuff. But they're trying to sell you stuff just because you, whether you're filing for a Hutton license or anything there, public records, they're scouring that all the time.
Yep.
And trying to get after you.
Yep. One of the interesting things that happens now is, and it's actually been happening for a long while, if I text Steve and say, I'm on my way, I get a little pop-up that says, do you want to share your location?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that share location is something I can turn on, but that doesn't guarantee it ever gets turned off.
Yep.
Not just to Steve, but to the world at large. How do you think a phone knows which cell tower to go to?
Even before GPS in your phone, the phone had to know where it was so it could ring when someone called you.
Right. And you go to your Google Maps or Apple Maps, and it says, oh, there's congestion in the next 4 miles. How does it know that? It's tracking every phone and every car that goes through, and they all slow down there. Yep.
There was a great case in a guy in England a few years ago.
Yeah.
Got 100 old cell phones, put them in a little red wagon, and started walking up and down the sidewalk of a busy street. And suddenly the street emptied of cars because all the mapping programs showed a congestion of 100 cars moving really, really slow.
Yep. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Neil from Honey I Falls, New York. Hi, Neil, what's up?
Hi, gentlemen and Nick.
Hey, Neil.
Hey.
Thanks for calling, Neil. Bye-bye.
I got a strike early, right?
Yeah.
So, are you there?
Yeah, you got a what?
Yeah. Yep. So I have a quick, fascinating anecdote, an amazing article out of Florida in the New York Times today.
Okay.
A 15-year-old boy was riding his bicycle without a helmet, I might add, at 10:30 at night. And he was struck by a vehicle that was coming in the opposite direction, and he T-boned the car. He was injured in that his head broke the front passenger window. And his AirPod flew out of his ear under the mat in the driver's car.
Uh-huh.
Now, the driver got out, dragged the guy off the road, and then took off.
Wow.
And they found his car with the AirPod.
Wow. That's amazing.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the guy is a convicted felon who didn't want to get into trouble.
Hit and run.
Yep.
Hit and run.
Yeah, it's more trouble.
The scene of an accident.
Vehicular manslaughter, yeah.
Yeah, and well, the kid's alive. He had a very severe injury to his bones in his face, but he's alive and he's going to survive.
One heck of a headache, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's how they got him.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, well, and that's the other thing. Every device now, whether it's an Android device or an iOS device, has my Find My My device.
Yeah. Yep.
And how do you think that works? They're being tracked all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
your phone is being tracked all the time. Your tablet is being tracked. Your iPods. Everything tracked all the time.
For you to be able to find it, other people might be able to find it too.
Yeah.
Although both Apple and Google have put some serious thought into anti-stalking issues. And in fact, part of the OS updates this week for both Android and iOS were the cross-talking. So Google devices will now be found on an iPhone, and Apple devices will now be found on an Android phone.
More importantly, each of them has a thing where if you are being tracked, if you've got an AirPod, not an AirPod, what do you call them?
AirTag.
AirTag from whatever company, whether it's Apple's AirTag or some clone, it tells you that. You're being followed by an AirTag. Well, okay, that's my AirTag. Okay, I don't care. Or, really? Where did that come from and where is it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's interesting is they've taken into account crowds. So I went to a wedding last year, and there's 100 Apple people there. So I look at my Find My, and there's 100 Apple people there.
Right, right.
But I didn't get a notification of AirTags near me. It must have known it was supposed to be a crowd of people because there were so many. If it was just one following
me,
then I probably would have got a message.
Right.
Amazing. Amazing.
But yeah, well, you're absolutely. That's a great article. Thank you.
Today's New York Times. You guys take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Yep. Have fun, Neil.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, I posted the link from the NBCWashington.com.
There you go.
Because New York Times is behind a paywall.
Yep.
So there's a trick for you. If you ever want to find an article behind a paywall, Google the title, and you'll find someone who carried the same article that's not behind a paywall.
Yeah, elsewhere.
But yeah.
This was in Florida.
We can't say it often enough. You are not anonymous. You're voluntarily carrying a device that tracks you everywhere in multiple ways. And you probably have multiple devices that do that.
Mm-hmm.
If Steve's got a phone and a tablet and probably AirPods, he's being tracked three ways.
And I have an AirTag in my car because it's too old to have LoJack in it.
Exactly right. So, you know, he's being tracked left and right and up and down, and everybody is. And it's a whole thing that we allow to happen because it's convenient.
But we
can't complain about lack of privacy.
We don't want the bad guys to get it, just the good guys.
Right.
Well,
right.
The technology doesn't know a good guy from a bad guy. It's a radio signal.
The technology doesn't care.
Sometimes there is no technological solution.
No.
Right. So if you're really seriously, if you want to be untrackable, then get out of your house. Go live in the woods. Don't take any technology at all with you. Learn to start a fire with two sticks.
Mm-hmm.
It's in this modern world, you are trackable. Done.
There was a bill or whatever it is going through British Parliament about encrypted messaging apps, that encrypted messaging apps must have a backdoor for law enforcement when feasible.
Right.
It's not feasible, so we're not going to
do it. Yeah, I say, who determines feasible?
Right. The EU is pushing through the same thing. I think that was the Rule 45, and that's going through EU Parliament. They didn't take off them when feasible. So every encrypted messaging app, WhatsApp, Telegram, Signal, must have a backdoor. Well, they don't say backdoor. Must have a way for government authorities to read the messages.
Right.
And every member country of the EU has slightly different laws.
Right.
So that can be an issue. So we've started seeing some of the big encryption companies. Was it Telegram? I think it might have been Telegram. Are leaving countries where a backdoor is required by law. So if you're using an encrypted messaging system, which they almost all are these days, the your message is encrypted at your end and decrypted at the other end.
Right.
Nobody can see it in the middle.
Right.
And so what the government wants is they want to be able to read those messages after some crime has occurred and we get your phone.
Right.
But that's not technologically possible.
Right.
So if you make a backdoor for law enforcement, it won't be very long before that backdoor is now public knowledge and everyone can read your encrypted messages.
Right, so there's no point in encrypting it. Well, right. the same thing is true of RCS messages.
Yeah.
Are encrypted end-to-end. Gmail is encrypted end-to-end, as long as it goes from a Gmail person to a Gmail person directly. So, you know, there's but we do not know if it's decryptable at Google, right? We do not know if the RCS message is decryptable at your phone provider. We simply do not know this one way or the other. So, you know, who do you trust? Proper answer is nobody.
It usually takes someone pointing out to the legislator, you know, that means your messages will be accessible too. Well, no, I don't want that.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. I want everybody else's.
Yeah. That's right. Not technologically feasible.
Right. Well, that was.
It's more than technologically capable to have a back door, or Steve Gibson called it once two front doors.
Right.
Because back doors is, you know, has a negative connotation. You can have two front doors. You can have two keys. But if someone gets that second key, doesn't matter if they're a good guy or a bad guy, that's now
you
lock
let
is.
Them into your house.
Yep.
Yep. That's exactly right. There's a lot more going on behind the scenes than we think, and there's a lot less security than we think.
It would scare people if they really got into it and did the research, because they're, again, being so complacent, thinking, oh, no problem. I'm safe there. I got a firewall.
And it's almost worse than that. The actual studies have shown that people will give up their password for a cookie.
Yeah, exactly.
A literal chocolate. Yeah. People don't think they have anything worth protecting. No one's going to want my stuff. I don't have any money. And we said earlier, I don't have any money in the bank. You got $5? I'll take it.
Also, 99% of the time, these things happen when you're in your own home.
Yeah.
And in your own home, you feel secure. You feel safe.
Yep.
No one can hurt me in here. So, you know, you're more, your guard is down. If somebody stopped you on the street and said, you know, here's a thing, I want to sell you this thing, you might be a little, you know, but at home, you're complacent.
You walk around a company with a clipboard, you'll get all the passwords you want.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It's, look.
People are the weakest link.
You know, they say don't say anything you don't want public. Everything's public. Everything is public on the internet. Whether you like it or not, it is visible, it is shareable, it is doable. So,
and how many times has Facebook been caught, you know, publishing things that were supposed to be private? Oh, sorry, we'll fix it.
Yeah. And that's then, all that happens.
Yep.
Oh, sorry.
Well, and that's part of the problem. There is currently no legal penalty for having a data breach or having bad code in your software. And so you apologize and move on. There needs to be some sort of legal ramification. Maybe your stock price goes down.
Right.
But very rarely is anyone prosecuted because, you know, there's a bug in the router that let someone into the pipeline system.
Right. Exactly. All right. That's it. We are done for another week. I want to thank Dave Enright, Steve Ray. I'm Nick Francesco. I really want to thank everyone who called in. Good questions this week. So we are done for a week, but we'll be back next week with a whole lot more of the longest running computer show in the known universe. That's Soundbites right here on the Truly Great and Truly Grateful to You, because as you know, we are solely member supported. So it's up to you whether we stay or go. Jazz 90.1. We will see you in just 166 hours. Be good to one another, will you?